Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome for the next hour to Free Forum.
Where do you think the most important changes need to take place to turn things around in terms of the big issues, both nationally and globally, like the economy, the environment, social justice? If we opened up the phones, I'm sure we'd get a wide range of answers. Some might say climate change is the critical global issue, so it must be clean energy. Others might say nothing will make as much difference for the world's people as educating and empowering girls and women. Closer to home, a case can be made that public financing of political campaigns would have the most impact on all such issues by making it possible for the power of the United States to become a greater force for good. All good answers. But today's guest gives another answer, and it's one that I share. Frances Moore LePay, who has herself been a force for good at least since the publication of the phenomenal bestseller Diet for a Small Planet in 1971, said that the greatest impact would follow from changing our minds. In her 18th book, Echo Mind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want, LePay argues that much of what is wrong with the world, from our eroding soil to our eroding democracies, results from ways of thinking that are out of sync with human nature and nature's rhythms. Humans are doers, she says, but our capacity for doing is undermined by 7 thought traps that leave us mired in fear, guilt, and despair, none of which are motivators to action. Drawing on the latest research in climate studies, anthropology, neuroscience, she weaves her analysis together with stories of real people the world over who, having shifted some basic thought patterns, are shifting the balance of power in our world. Chapter by chapter, LePay takes us from thought trap to thought leap, and with each shift, challenges become opportunities. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, and media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Frances Moore LePay is the co-founder of Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, and the Small Planet Institute, a collaborative network for research and popular education seeking to bring democracy to life, which she leads with her daughter, Anna LePay. Frances and Anna have also co-founded the Small Planet Fund, which channels resources to democratic social movements worldwide. As I said, LePay is the author of 18 books, including Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad, Hope's Edge, You Have the Power, Choosing Courage in a Culture of Fear, and her latest, Echo Mind. Welcome again to Free Forum, Frances Moore LePay.
Thank you so much, Terrence.
I like listeners to get to know the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So tell us a bit about your path. First, how did Diet for a Small Planet happen? And then how have you seen your role in the world in the 4 decades since?
Whoa. Well, Diet for a Small Planet came about because I was a desperate young woman or agitated young woman trying to figure out my role in life. And at the time, I was in Berkeley. I had just left a graduate program in social work because I couldn't see how really it was helping me understand why was all this suffering increasing. And I decided that if I could just know why hunger in the world, that would unlock the mysteries of economics and politics. Because I realized that the first thing every species does is feed itself and feed its offspring, and we hadn't yet succeeded at that as a species. So that was a lot of time sitting in the UC Berkeley Ag Library. It was the most uninhabited one on the campus, and I found a friendly librarian, and I developed my research technique I call following my nose. And I let one question lead to the next question. And somewhere in those first few months, I said, oh, my God, all the experts with their PhDs and head of all the agencies and the newspaper headlines are telling us we'd run out of food. But we actually have more than enough food for all of us, and we are creating scarcity from plenty. And that was the beginning of my adult life. And in a sense, EcoMind is the direct, you know, daughter of my 18th book is the direct, in a sense, straight line from Diet for a Small Planet, because I've been asking the question ever since then, wait a minute, why would such a bright species do this? Why would we create a world together that none of us as individuals would choose? Why would we create the very scarcity that we say we're trying to escape? And that is what I'm trying to answer in this new book. And so when Diet for a Small Planet came out, actually it started out as a one-page handout.
Oh, my gosh.
And it grew. But
one-page handouts were very popular in Berkeley.
I was going to tack it around on all the bulletin boards I could find, and then I thought, well, I should know a little bit more about this before I say anything. And it grew and grew into a little book that was published by the founders of Paperback Publishing, Ian and Betty Ballantyne, with David Brower and Friends of the Earth co-published it. So that was the beginning of my life, yes.
And then when I asked about your path since then, of course, you did, you know, what? I'm going to encapsulate 40 years. But one thing that I've noticed in following your work is that some things have continued to deal with nutrition and even, you know, one of the institutes you started. But over the last few years, it seems to me most of your stuff was about democracy. Mm-hmm. How do we make it real? How do we bring it to life? Mm-hmm. How do we get the good news out and that sort of thing? So how have you seen that?
Mm-hmm.
And then we will talk more about EchoMind because I do see where
it's
one of those things that ties them all together, I'm
absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. Well, by the 1980s even, one of my little, you know, sound bites that I thought sounded smart was hunger is not caused by a scarcity of food. It's caused by a scarcity of democracy. And, yeah, that sounds great. And then I realized I would say this and, okay, show me. Where is this democracy that is vital enough and strong enough to actually end hunger? People could sort of intuitively know what I was getting at, that it's the scarcity of power, that people lack power to access the food that is there. That's the real problem, not the scarcity of food. But so I started having to answer that question. Okay, I have to answer that question. What does democracy look like that could actually end hunger? Because if it could end hunger, then it could address climate change and everything else. And so I traveled the world any number of times in ways, both literally and figuratively, but always looking for what do I mean by democracy in this sense, and finally named it. By the early 90s, I'd named it living democracy. And because clearly this, what I call dumbed down duo of markets plus voting, you know, this very frail notion of democracy, it's failing. It's failing here. It's failing. Look at all the countries in the world that have both of these. They have elections in the Philippines or in El Salvador or in India, and yet majority of people are living in misery. And look what's happening here. We are becoming more and more like those countries. So I knew that democracy had to be much more than simply markets and voting. And so I began then to describe it in a book I co-authored in the 1990s called The Quickening of America, because we couldn't put democracy in the title because, oh, yawn city, you know, nobody's. But I snuck it into this idea.
It was the subtitle, wasn't it?
Probably. Yeah, no, I don't.
No.
I forget the subtitle, actually.
Yeah, I just remember.
But Rebuilding Our Nation, Remaking Our Lives.
Yeah. There you go.
So I've been trying to, and this is how I end EchoMind, actually, saying that, although I tried to dispel the notion of lack throughout the book, I say there is a lack, and is a lack of a concept, a viable, believable concept of democracy. Because if we don't have that, how can we solve any of these other problems? And so I give a number of stories about democracy as a culture of engagement, a way of life that involves little kids all the way up to all of us in every dimension of life, from economic life. And I tell the stories, for example, one of my favorite zingers that surprises virtually everybody, still me too, is that we think of our global economy, and it's true, becoming more and more concentrated and anti-democratic. And at the very same time, there are likely more people who are members of cooperatives, which are also growing, than who own shares in publicly traded companies. And my favorite comparison in that regard is I looked at the numbers of people who have gotten jobs in India as part of the, you know, the call centers and high-tech industry, and compared them with the jobs created by Indian villagers in dairy cooperatives.
Yes.
And many more jobs have been created by Indian villagers, women, largely in creating cooperatives. So, yes, Diet for a Small Planet then led me directly to say, okay, I've got to go beneath all the issues to the question of the process itself, to democracy itself, and how do we begin to create a really compelling, engaging, exciting, exuberant vision of democracy through practical stories and experience. And so I then created an organization, co-created an organization called the Center for Living Democracy. So that has been something of this path of mine. But the real world life changer for me that led to this book happened a decade ago with my daughter.
Let me see, before you tell us about that life-changing moment, let me tell people that I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Frances Moore LePay about her book Echo Mind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. You can learn more at Small Planet, one word, smallplanet.org. So, the world-changing moment.
Well, I had what must be every parent's dream, if they could even imagine this. But I traveled the world with my daughter, who was exactly the age that I was when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet. She was 26. We traveled the world together 10 years ago, looking, meeting people in every, you know, five continents who are birthing living democracy. And one kind of goosebump moment is we were
I'll tell you, I got a goosebump moment just when you said you traveled the world with your daughter, because I can imagine.
Oh, my God. It was so fun. But one night, we ended up sleeping in a seed storage shed in the foothills of the Himalayas. And before we went to sleep, under our mosquito nets, I looked at the wall, and there was a poster, a beautiful poster of trees and animals and plants of all kinds. And it was the poster for Navdanya, which is the Indian farmers collaborative that has been created by Vandana Shiva, who is one of the heroes who we were meeting. And I looked there, and the only word in English, it was all Hindi, the only word in English was living democracy. And so Vandana and I, continents, you know, a world apart, had come up with the same metaphor for what we were creating. And now on the 10th anniversary of the Small Planet Fund, Vandana and I are both speaking in New York to celebrate 40 years of the food movement and 10 years of the Small Planet Fund. So, but that travel with my daughter, we sat in the shacks of landless workers in Brazil who were getting land for the first time through the landless workers movement, a movement that is probably the largest social movement in our hemisphere that is based on precisely the themes of EcoMind, that we are by nature cooperative, and yet we need structures to bring that forth. That, as you alluded to in your introduction to me, that I believe that the cultural story today is actually not just malaligned with human nature, it's perversely aligned with human nature, because it's instructed to create exact conditions which history shows us, lab experiments on us show, bring out the worst in us. So no wonder depression is a global pandemic. But anyway, back to 2000 when I traveled with my daughter. So we traveled to Africa and met Wangari Maathai and went into the villages and danced with the women who were planting trees and now have planted 40 million trees. And so one of the themes then of EcoMind is that we have to be ready for surprises. If we really think like an ecosystem in continuous change where everything is connected, then it's not possible to know what's possible. And so we strive then for this kind of boldness, but with humility, that we don't know. So would I have said, oh, yeah, Wangari's movement that started with 7 trees on Earth Day in 1977, oh, yeah, that's going to end up with a global initiative that in Kenya has planted 40 million trees and won her the Nobel Peace Prize. No, that couldn't happen. But it did. So the theme of this book is this: to shift from pessimism or despair or simple blind optimism to becoming possibilists by really thinking like an ecosystem, meaning what are the conditions that bring out the best in our organism, the human organism, but also what are the rhythms of nature that we can align with? And if we do, then how we can move away from these fear messages, the thought traps of we've hit the limits of a finite earth is one that you hear so much. And that, to me, is still locked into this scarcity mind, the mechanical mind. And so where does it lead us? I just realized this morning, this is not in the book, but before we went on, I said I had this thought that I wish I had had before the book. And I realized that one of the problems with we've hit the limits of a finite earth as the fundamental environmental message, you know, is that it says, okay, if we've hit nature's limits, then we'd better try for something unnatural like GMOs or like some mechanical fix of seeding the, you know, all these different
– The geoengineering.
Of the atmosphere
and so on.
Yeah, because if we've hit nature's limits, we've got to do something that we can invent that's better than nature.
Better than nature.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's exactly the opposite. We've got to trust nature, not to fear that she's stingy and left us high and dry, because clearly it's crazy to think that we've hit the limits of a finite Earth when we know that each day the sun supplies our Earth 15,000 times the dose of energy that we're currently using in fossil fuels. Another way of saying it is that just 5 days of the sunshine on our Earth is equivalent to all the known reserves of all fossil fuels. So, we clearly have hit – no, what we have hit the limits of is the limits of the malalignment.
Right.
And, you know, so then
– we hit the limits of this way of looking
way
at things.
Of looking
at
things.
And this way of manipulating things and this way of putting things together and taking things apart.
Right. Exactly. And so, you know, I talk about how what many great leaders that are my heroes today are showing us, that – the mind shift that's suggested by thinking like an ecosystem, there is no waste. That waste is just a false concept. In fact, I was just at Omega Institute 2 weeks ago in New York, and they told me I was in the greenest building in America. But what they do, and this is just one of millions of examples now emerging, where they have 25,000 gallons a day of water being used, drawn out of their aquifer, being used for everything from toilets to cooking, etc. And within 36 hours through what they call this eco machine designed by, among others, John Todd, who is the great water master. And 36 hours, it's clean enough to go back in pure into the aquifer. And they said, never use the word wastewater. There is no such thing. We have to – water is water. And we have to just to think of it that way, that it is always potentially clean and usable. So I think that, and certainly with food, as we align with nature rather than this idea of hitting the limits, what I'm saying, the alternative, the thought leap, I call it in EcoMind, the thought leap from hit the limits of a finite Earth is alignment. How do we align with? And from limits to alignment. And so one of the big shifts that happened to my brain when I was writing the book is that in the world we live in, it's all about cutting back and cutting back and cutting back fossil fuel use, right? And of course,
in other words, when you say it's all about, well, I wouldn't say that's what solutions seem to be all about.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you, Terrence. Yes. Solutions are all about cutting back. And of course, absolutely, we need to reduce our
use. To be more efficient, to conserve.
Absolutely. All of that. But with an eco mind, we can add to it this more – I don't know. It's more graceful or beautiful to me that what we're really doing is we're balancing the carbon cycle. We're putting way too much carbon in now, and we're taking way too much back into the earth. If we think of rebalancing the cycle as alignment instead of just limits, what happens? We reprioritize farming. We reprioritize forests. And we realize that among the climate heroes that we need to be supporting are the world's small farmers who we could help to become true agro-artists of becoming the not just food producers of healthier food, but also soil restorers storing carbon for us. And so suddenly they become much more important than simply, you know, poor people in the third world who are so desperate that they need our aid. Rather, we see them as, you know, our helpers in aligning with nature. And so one of the stories that I love to tell is about Niger. Niger, all we heard last year was famine. Niger ranks last in the Human Development Index. And yet, over the last 20 years, this very poor African country has re-greened, meaning restored from near desert-like conditions, 12.5 million acres, nourishing, re-establishing 200 million trees, establishing food security for 2.5 million people. Yet we don't hear this story of possibility. And it was No, a lot of it was networks of farmers teaching other farmers. Yes, there were NGOs involved in supporting this, but none of it involved GMOs or anything high tech. And it involved great building of confidence and dignity on the part of farmers. And there was one beautiful quote that I used in the book from a Niger farmer who said, "We stopped the desert and everything changed."
Wow. Stopping the desert means stops the desert from
encroaching and, in fact, reestablishing what could have been easily become desert. So this is the kind of shift of worldview.
Very good. That's Frances Moore LePay. We're talking about her newest book, Echo Mind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. You can learn more at smallplanet.org. I could tell that from the answer to that question – that I could ask about three questions and the whole hour would be over, which means we could do more than this time. But there are some things. One thing I want to talk about is the process of this book, because you said that, and it's interesting. You know, I don't know if you've done it on previous books, but if this is the first one you've done it on, you know, someone who has done something 17 times and says, "Nope, I'm going to do this a different way," that you put drafts online and crowdsourced. What? Responses? Feedback?
Yeah.
What was that process like?
Well, it was one of those – it's kind of like a joke of be careful what you ask for, because I did this. Fear, I admit. You know, there's a lot in my book about how we cope with fear. Well, fear doesn't need to stop us, but maybe we take incremental steps. So I was afraid. I felt like – honestly, I'd never said this publicly, but I was afraid that my message was so different from my buddies' messages that maybe – maybe I, you know, needed to test it out before I really went whole hog with it. So
And let me just see if I get what you're saying there when you said then your buddy's messages. Much of what you do in this book is you say, well, the normal environmental message is X. You hear this, but look at it this way. And so that's what you're talking about is the other people who are looking at the same problems, the same issues, working maybe for the same solutions.
Absolutely. My heroes, my buddies.
We're saying things differently.
Yes.
And we assume thinking things differently.
Yes. And I was scared to be, you know, this is my message that breaking with your tribe is really scary. So I wanted to get it out there in a way that kind of my feet in the water and see if people, you know, engage with it. And so it was very exciting. And I had study groups formed and professors used it.
The book is even written.
Yeah, and I had a various student groups. Like there was an NYU seminar that sent me back 10 pages of comments. And the challenge was digesting it all. And I had several professors who went through it, you know, chapter by chapter and said, well, it would be much more helpful to me if you did thus and so. And I did it because I wanted it to be helpful to professors in environmentalism. So, it was quite rewarding. And so –
at what stage did you put it out there?
Well, it was –
did you have a first draft of the whole book?
Oh, yeah.
Because I think I mentioned it before I went on the air that Chris Anderson, with one or two of his books, The Long Tail and then Free, actually kind of blogged them, got all the comments, and then they fed the next – and so he
– maybe I'll do that next time.
His went – you see, his grew with the comments. Uh-huh. You had a draft that you put out there.
Yes, although there's a whole new chapter that wasn't in the original book. And, there's a lot of changes. There are a lot of changes based on the comments that I received. And the last chapter in particular is the name of it is very different. And the last chapter is about the thought trap, it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
And the thought leap is it's not too late for life. And life loves life. And life will that what really does us in is not a challenge. It is feeling powerless. And it's really that message that what human beings are we are by nature problem solvers. We are doers. And
the other thing is, I mean, I know it runs through the book. The other thing is that by nature we are teammates.
Yes.
This weak, slow, small animal would never have survived if it weren't for social cohesion.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm very indebted to a particular anthropologist, Sarah Blaffer Hardy, H-R-D-Y, at Berkeley, who has written many books, but absolutely fantastic book called Mothers and Others, who argues that actually, rather than the canon of anthropology had been that, you know, some of our cooperative nature was bonding through warfare, but she points out that actually it couldn't have happened that way because there's no evidence of warfare until so recent in our evolution. And she said, no, what it is that the dependency of our babies, the fact that our babies had, that we evolved in such a way that our babies were raised then by not just the mother, but by aunties and uncles and brothers and sisters and grandpas and father, the whole, literally the village. And so we then had to learn a level of trust. No other primate trusts others to nurture their babies the way that human species does. And it's that the mirror neurons, she would say that very much about that. We almost have to trust your infant to another person. You almost have to believe that you can see into their minds. You have to have that level of trust in them. And so, as I say in the book, we can thank our helpless, demanding babies for making us
who
we are.
It's interesting, of course, that the reason that we need to take care of our babies for so long,
yes,
is because of the size of their brains.
Right, exactly.
And so no other species may be needed
right,
as much help
right.
as we do.
And so I also talk about in the book, the irony is that it's these big brains that evolved because of our cooperation that now are giving us ideas, telling us that we're not cooperators. I mean, how funny is that?
No,
how ironic is that?
That's exactly what I heard as I was saying it.
It's crazy.
Let me challenge you on one point, which is that, and it's interesting in hearing you say, here you are challenging your buddies. And as I was reading your book, I felt this challenge, which is not a huge undermining one, but because of its title and because of some of your writing, it appears that the book and the shifts in thinking are about the environment. And I see it as so much broader than that. I have often said,
thank you.
Reality is not dead, separate, or static. It's alive, interdependent, and dynamic. And that way of seeing reality, not the environment, not nature, reality is the way when we see that way, is the way we're going to solve every problem and deal with everything in a more evolved way.
Oh, I am completely there. And I hope that comes through in the book because I talk about poverty, for example. I talk the great inequality. This is all coming out of the same mindset.
One thing I might suggest then is up front in your interviews or in anything, make it real clear this isn't an environmental book. That Eco Mind is because that, why call it anything else? It
right.
is the way an
right.
ecological system works.
Works, but it applies to everything.
That's right.
It's interesting.
Because eco mind could mean economic mind.
Right, exactly.
And because eco is house, right?
I mean, right, like right, right. No, I think you're absolutely right.
By the way, this is a little difference I have with Kenny Ozabel of Bioneers.
Yes, of Bioneers.
When he talks about Bioneers and says, environment. I said, no.
Right.
Systems thinking,
right.
learning from nature,
absolutely.
Following nature's 3.5 billion years of R&D is not about the environment.
I totally agree. And I hope that does, of course, come through because throughout I talk about examples because one has to limit a book in some way. But I do talk about other issues than environmental issues.
Definitely.
But I totally, totally agree with you.
Let me ask
that's why I end with democracy itself.
Exactly. No,
right.
I see that's where
right.
it ends up. Let me ask you one other thing, which is that you make the point that it took how long from the time Copernicus?
It's
over 100 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and people often say that. Copernicus said, look, we're
right.
not the center. And
right.
it took 100 years. One of the points I make is that science over 100 years ago saw that everything is related, dynamic, basically alive, and it is over 100 years with all this modern communication, all this sophisticated universities and everything, that the mechanical worldview, the dead mechanical worldview still persists.
Yeah.
I mean, no shame on those people hundreds of years ago.
Right.
How
exactly.
can we be so
exactly.
slow?
Exactly, exactly. How is a big question, and it's stunning. And for me, the most obvious thing in the book along these lines, and yet in some ways the most profound, if I can say that about my own book, but it's so obvious, and that is really seeing the human organism as just another organism that is a product of our environment. And so we can drop then this whole idea of whether we're good or bad and accept, truly accept, that not just a few of us, but most of us in the wrong circumstances will behave absolutely, will drop our cooperation, will behave absolutely cruelly toward one another, whether we're looking at the Holocaust, as I say in the book. It was not the the result of a madman and a few sadistic guards. If you read the book Ordinary Men, for example, about Battalion 101 in Hamburg, Germany, ordinary soldiers went out point blank murdering Jews, 38,000 of them in a very short time. In other words, look at the Stanford prison experiment where when they divided these normal young people into two groups, guards and prisoners, it was supposed to last for 2 weeks, that experiment. It had to be halted in 6 days because the brutality was like Abu Ghraib brutality, according to the professor who was looking at Abu Ghraib and saying, you know, it looks very much like what the students, these young people did in Stanford prison experiment. So, but this is, to me, to really embrace the eco-mind, that what you're saying is to really let go of the mechanical worldview. We have to grow up as a species and say we are capable, in the wrong environment, of being inhuman is you know
in quotes
because it is part of our humanity, and as long as we hold the view, oh, it's the Wall Street banker, it's the bad guy in a cave somewhere in Afghanistan, it's the other, and not recognize that all of us in the wrong conditions, well, not all of us, but most of us, and we don't know whether we're the ones who will behave badly or not until we are put to that test. We have to assume that all of us. So the real takeaway for me of the eco mind is, okay, we know pretty much what brings out the best in us. It's the dispersion of power.
So where, I hear where you're going there. One thing that jumps out to me is what you're saying is, so I'm not offering you just positivity that, oh, no, we're not like that. Recognizing, acknowledging that we are like that means that we have to proactively do what we can to create the circumstances that bring out the best.
So we have power. We have power. If we can accept that about ourselves and therefore go to that root and say, okay, what kind of democracy do we create that keeps power dispersed instead of what I call privately held government, which is what we have today?
Absolutely. Okay, we're at about the halfway mark. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking, both of us, very quickly with Frances Moore LePay about her book, Ecomind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. And you can learn more at smallplanet.org. What does it mean to think like an ecosystem?
I think it partly means thinking like a two-year-old in the sense of always asking why. Because you summarized it just a few moments ago. Thinking like an ecosystem means that we accept that everything is in constant flux because everything is connected and everything is affecting everything else. There's a beautiful book called The Music of Life by a physiologist, Dennis Noble, in Oxford, and he writes that the biological systems, there is no, you know, control system telling the rest what to do. There's a, he calls it a form of democracy in which all elements, all the components of a system are creating all other components of a system as they interact with one another.
I think one of the terms is emergent design.
Yes, emergent design.
Versus,
absolutely.
Versus,
which is a very Buddhist concept.
Structured sort of design. Emergent.
Yes, everything is emergent. So that is it. But back to the two-year-old. But what's so exciting to me about the ecological worldview, this view of continuous change, one, it means that the only choice we don't have is whether to change the world, because every single thing, everything I'm saying, everything we're doing today, every choice we're making about what we touch and what we put into, that's changing the world. So that's, we have power. But the other thing it does, if everything is connected, then this two-year-old question of why, it takes on new meaning. That there's a way to actually examine what is the connectedness. We know, for example, that the reason that America today, our country, seems so stuck is not just if we keep asking why. It's not just because there's some crazies unleashed up on us who are just spouting these wild ideas that somehow we can get away with no government at all and all of it. That there are reasons that have to do with all the influences on us that have been creating a kind of sense of separateness and this the way our minds have been affected by this notion that we are simply isolated competitors. And then that message of anti-government then clicks into this preset kind of mechanical worldview. So all I'm saying is that the eco-mind, yes, it's all about the sense of possibility that is inherent in an emergent understanding of life. But it also it means to me that it pays more to always be asking why and not stay at the surface level. For example,
let me just
yes.
One of the things I hear in what you're saying is I look at American culture and I see a total preoccupation with symptoms.
Yes, exactly.
And what we're talking about here is when that 2-year-old asks why, is to get to root.
Yes.
So you get to upstream or to root causes. And what's interesting is that the old word for root, is radical.
Yes.
It is. I asked someone once, a rather wise young man I just met, I said, how do you describe yourself politically? He said, I'm a radical. And I said, oh. He said, I try to get to the root of things.
Exactly. I wish we could reclaim that and redignify that term in that way. But, I think one of the other thought leaps in the book is precisely this idea that as long as we define the problem in symptoms, that the symptom is that greedy consumer out there grabbing too much stuff. And that leaves us at the level, one, of making people feel guilty for the pleasures that this world, and we're living in the U.S. where people are so just life is so difficult, and then you're pointing a finger at them and saying, no, you dirty consumer, you're messing everything up. It doesn't get very far. But it also keeps us at that level that consumerism is a symptom of, from an eco-mind perspective, it's a symptom of the malaise in our society, that people who are lacking a sense of status in community, a sense of connection, a sense of belonging in community, then seek that belonging through acquisitions. As I say, can we shift from identity through common purchases to identity through common purposes, the feeling of allegiance with one another toward common goals. And when our lives lack that meaning, then we are more oriented toward purchases. But it also is wrong in so many other ways, or unhelpful. I don't want to use the word wrong. It's just unhelpful, because when we think back, so many of, as I write about it in that chapter, that so many of the things that are so taxing to our environment, we would never have chosen if we had a choice. Would we have chosen? Take bottled water, 30 billion plastic bottles of water. If we had been able to choose as a democratic polity, do we want to invest in our public water systems at a fraction of the price, and so that we could all have free water wherever we go and healthy water? Wouldn't we all have preferred that to
the creeping reality that
of this? Now we have plastic soup,
yes,
in the Pacific Ocean the size of 2 states of Texas. So if we
and our public water is still needs work.
Needs a lot of work, because we've abandoned our public water system. So the point is that by asking why, rather than just saying, oh, you bad person for buying plastic bottled water. Yes, we should not be buying plastic, and I don't, and I encourage. And in fact, I tell a story in the book, one of my young heroes who collected 900 signatures in a month in DePauw University and got them to ban bottled water on campus. And so, yes, we have to be doing that, and we have to be understanding, going deeper to understand how we were denied choice of the aligned with nature choice of having public water systems in which, as I spoke of earlier, which there is no waste because, we're constantly returning it to nature and using plants and microorganisms to clean that water for us. And so we have plentiful water and plentiful clean water. So I think that is the kind of system thinking that we're all capable of. And it's so much more fun. When I visited this water station, this water purification building, it was just beautiful. The plants, you feel like you're in paradise.
Yeah.
And it was a wastewater treatment. And they bring little kids, fifth, sixth graders who love to think about, what goes into a toilet. And here, that's when those things are really interesting to you.
Yeah.
And to imagine that all that stuff is actually creating these beautiful, beautiful plants, and nothing here smells, and how amazing. And so it's stimulating to all of our senses in such a positive way. So this is the question that you asked me. I kind of went off. But
what I'm going to do right now, let me ask you this one. That's Frances Morlepay. We're talking about her book, Eco Mind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. We've got about 17 minutes left, and I want to ask a couple of questions at the very end. Do you have a quick way of going through the seven traps and the seven leaps?
I could try. Okay. I haven't done it before.
Okay.
There could be many more or many fewer, but the ones that I've picked, I'm not saying they are the thought traps, but I start out with the thought trap that no growth is the answer. And that we hear often.
So that's the trap. In other words,
the trap
that's the
is
message.
That the problem is growth.
Right.
And I argue with that, saying, wait a minute, that blesses what we're doing now with the word that I want to keep as positive. I want my granddaughters to grow. I want my love to grow. So grow, I don't want to abandon it to describe something that is actually our current system is largely waste and destruction. So let's not call it growth. And so the chapter, the thought leap is let's drop the whole notion of growth and no growth. And let's find language of what we really want is vitality and flourishing and life enhancing societies and developing the measures that will bring us that. And just forget this whole idea of growth, no growth, because it gets us nowhere.
So it's that I mean, to rephrase what you just said, growth in quality,
yes,
that's fine.
Thank you.
Endless growth in quantity and waste,
yes,
not
yes,
so much. Okay.
Yes. And so the second one is that consumerism is killing us. And I just spoke about that. The thought
right.
leap is understanding that consumerism is just a symptom, and what we need is real choice. And as we develop real choice, that actually we can have more ease and joy and pleasure in our lives. And it's not about cutting back the goodies in life. It is actually having more beauty. And I talk about what is luxury. I discovered in writing this book, when I really thought about what is luxury to me, it is beauty. And we can all create more beauty in our lives rather than less. So it's really a reframing of that idea that somehow we greedy little consumers are the problem. The third one is we've talked about is we've hit the limits of a finite planet. And so the shift then is as we align with nature's laws, with nature's rhythms, there's more than enough for all to live well. And again, it's so much more stimulating to the senses and fun, as we were just talking about the water question. The fourth one is that human nature is simply materialistic, greedy, and selfish.
And competitive.
And competitive. Competitive. And that we have to somehow change nature if we're going to make this turn toward life. And I say, no. I identify six very pro-social qualities, starting with cooperation and empathy that evolved over eons of time when we lived in tightly knit tribes. So the thought leap is that we are neither good nor bad, but an eco mind tells us that we can be both depending upon the conditions, the social ecology that we create for ourselves, whether it's bringing forth the best in us or the worst in us, and that our current system is actually perversely aligned because it is structured by concentrating power and so much secrecy and so much blaming in it that it is perversely aligned with our nature, actually stifling these positive qualities in us and bringing forth our capacity for uncaring. So the fifth thought trap has to do with, and actually it's one of my favorites.
Yes, it is, because it's the one that's kind of sneaky sort of.
Well, it's this idea that human beings hate rules, that freedom is freedom from rules. Of course, this is now the Tea Party line that somehow any kind of regulation is anti-freedom.
I interviewed Van Jones a couple of days ago, and he said, you know, the Pledge of Allegiance doesn't end with liberty. It ends with liberty and justice for all.
Ooh, you know? Beautiful, beautiful. Well, actually, when you think about a ruleless society – is absolutely the end of freedom. You know, what would it mean to try to get through LA if there were no rules? You would have no freedom. You would not be able to think about or do anything. You would be stuck. So, again, the alignment is the question, that rules give, whether it's marriage vows or the Ten Commandments or how we
– or an agreement in a contract.
Exactly. They give structure, meaning, order, and connection.
Yeah. I mean, the way I always think about that actually is sports.
Absolutely.
You know.
Everything has rules. That's what makes it fun.
You couldn't play basketball without the rules.
Absolutely. So nature is all about rules. So again, the thought leap is to say that it is the rules work and they take off and enhance our freedom and enhance the environment if they are aligned with, if in the sense if we're part of creating them, if they make sense to us, they can take off and work. And we have to then recognize that part of that is who we are, is rule makers and also rule enforcers. And I talk about the Indian forest management groups, of which there are now 10 million households involved in democratic management of their own forests. But they have to set the rules and enforce the rules. And if somebody's breaking them, you have to call on your neighbor and say, hey. And that's hard for us to do, but we can step up and do that.
And let me go back to the point she was making was that the thought trap is that humans hate rules.
Yes.
And that means, you know, you got good ideas, but they'll never work because humans don't.
Right. Right. And that freedom, therefore, is no rules. And my argument is freedom is all about rules. It is rules that, in a way, give our lives, make us feel free.
Enriching, nourishing.
Because we can count on certain things and we are free then to be creative and to be loving. So it's a complete reframe of the whole notion of this rules are restrictive. And then the next one is about that we're so technology addicted and so urbanized that we can't possibly be genuine environmentalists because we're so disconnected from nature. And the thought leap is that, wait a minute, a few generations or a few decades can't knock it out of us. And there's brilliant and such moving research showing that, you know, just the most minimal exposure to nature has healing effects on us. It has cognitive effects that are very positive. British researchers said that exposure to green spaces is so healthy that we could cut the health gap between rich and poor by half if poor people had as much access to green space as rich people. I mean, just to show how dramatic it is. So there's a lot there in that chapter about how through the food movement, of which I've been part all my adult life, is such a venue, such an avenue into that reconnection with the earth and how healing that is. And so it's just a little pep talk in a way. The thought leap is, look, we're soft-wired to connect with nature, and we just have to just scratch the surface a little bit, and we're right there.
Just one instance. There's a documentary that I'm going to have the producer on soon, Urban Roots. Do you know about this? It's that Detroit.
Mm, yes.
Detroit, the city that's been ravaged by the Rust Belt failures and so on, is a center of urban farming. And
yes.
People, you know, at the moment when hope should be gone, are actually turning to taking neighborhood farms and that it's bringing this wonderful life back into people,
into the city. Yeah, in EcoMind, I give these amazing statistics that if they used all the land they could use in Detroit to grow fruits and vegetables, they could meet a huge proportion of the healthy needs of the entire population of that city.
Yeah, one of the things we're missing right here, I just want to say to listeners, is the stories. Both of us, before we went on the air, said how important the stories
are.
Well,
I tried to throw a few in.
But, I mean, you know, doing everything we're doing in an hour, we're not going to get to enough of the stories. But the book is full of them. So this is not just Francis's good ideas.
Right. No, I'm fundamentally, all my books now are storybooks. That's who we are. We're storytellers, and that's what carries the new meme. And so the final thought trap is it's too late. And even saying that, I can feel my body react. And so basically what I'm saying there is, you know, it's what is it too late for? It is not too late for life, that life loves life. We create the conditions, as Janine Binias, the brilliant author of Biomimicry, said, life creates the conditions that are conducive to life. Unfortunately, because our brain is doing tricks on us, that we're actually creating the conditions that are denying life. But we can use that brain now to see what we're doing. This is the moment where we can now have the consciousness to make that turn. If we can fill the one lack I talk about in EcoMind is the lack of a concept of a living democracy. And so a lot of that last chapter is pumping us up to believe that we have it in us to be living Democrats, small d, in the sense that there's new evidence about from the wisdom of crowds and, you know, that kind of literature, but also, you know, new articles in Science, for example, saying that there is this collective intelligence factor that we as groups, when groups are organized well, so that we are sensitive to one another, we share airtime with one another, so to speak, that we come up with better solutions than the average IQs of the people in the group. There is a qualitative advantage to group decision making.
I mean, that goes way back to that thing that we talked about early in thing, that what defines us as,
yes,
surviving all these years and having the power we have in the natural world.
Yes.
Is those qualities.
And so one of the stories that I tell is about the state I grew up in, which, and still this story just absolutely blows my mind, Texas, that in the 1990s, the utility companies in Texas brought together in a form called deliberative polls. This is James Fishkin's work at Stanford now, he is. But it's a collaborative meeting of random citizens brought together by utility companies in Texas to weigh the options for what kind of energy do they want to invest in the state. And people came in with one view, and they shifted quite a bit as they saw the evidence. Even though it was very balanced from all perspectives of fossil fuel and renewable energy, they shifted their votes, in a sense, toward renewable energy. And now experts are saying that because of investment in wind energy in Texas, partly as a result of these citizens coming together in group decision making, that Texas has helped make the U.S. a wind leader in the world in wind energy installation.
One of the things that I hear in those sorts of deliberative situations is, what we hear so much of in our culture, in our politics, is polls. And polls very often are, there's no information given.
Right.
There are just questions asked. And whenever people do polls or this sort of thing, where you get the information and then you're asked the questions.
Right.
That's informed democracy.
Yes, this is deliberative. The key word here is deliberative.
You know, one place that's happened curiously recently was that I think the Peterson Foundation did some town halls about the budget,
mm-hmm,
and they presented the evidence, and they did not get the results from those audiences that they thought they were going to get.
Mm-hmm.
They got
mm-hmm
the results sort of maybe we should have more taxes. Maybe mm-hmm we should do certain things. That
exactly
notion of informed democracy is so different from polled democracy.
Right. And another beautiful example of this is recently in some of the towns that were devastated by tornadoes and hurricanes. And I heard one of the people working with these communities to rebuild. And when people come together, people who were divided on all sorts of things and thought that sustainable was some lefty plot, that actually when they could talk about it and learn about it, they went whole hog. That's not a good metaphor for me, is it? But anyway, they went very strongly in the direction of renewable energy. And one of the most beautiful stories I heard, I think it was Joplin, but it was a story about how they had the children there as part of the deliberation, and they, as part of the rebuilding of their community after the devastation, they had to decide where to place the school. And the parents wanted to put it in the center between two towns, have a regional schools. And the children were all there saying, no, we want at least half the children to be able to walk to school. Even if we have to go further, we want to have at least half of us be able to walk to school. And so, I was just so touched. And I also think it's a brilliant move to put children in adults' meetings. I think adults probably behave much better. And so they ended up all agreeing on placing the new school in one of the towns.
Let me ask you a big question, and we've sort of already answered it, but I ask it occasionally on this show. And it's that if you could put yourself 25 years in the future and look back from there, did we turn things around? And if we did, how did it happen?
Well, I will never give you a straight answer to that. I'm a possibilist. As a possibilist, all I can say is what is possible. And the metaphor that appeals to me is that we are in a giant storm like our species has never seen before. And at least in Boston recently, when the storm hit, we had this mild hurricane and a lot of roots were exposed. And this is my metaphor for this time. there is such a storm and we are seeing these roots. And if we can just really take this time to look at those roots and to trust ourselves. This is all about power. Another way of saying what EcoMind is about we are now giving away our power, we human beings, and by trusting ourselves, trusting that we can come together and come up with solutions that better than anything that can be done just by turning our fate over to some market system that continues to concentrate power and bring out the worst in us. That is what I'm really talking about. And if we can see this time of great challenge as a message that maybe we've just misunderstood our own nature and we haven't really embraced what nature has to teach us, rather than seeing nature as skimpy, it's not delivering enough or a threat to us, why don't we just think of nature as our ultimate teacher? How does it work? Everything's connected, and there's enough for all of us.
Okay, thank you very much. Again, the book is EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. The website is Small Planet, one word, smallplanet.org. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to the podcast. You can do that either at iTunes or at my website, terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. And you can also sign up at my website or at iTunes to have a podcast delivered to you weekly for free. And you can also sign up at the site or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com. Ask me to send you a weekly announcement. And what I do is I tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 2, 3, 4 articles to give you some background. Thanks to Stan Mizrahi and Mark Maxwell in production, Matt Perez in traffic, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again 1 week from today. And finally, thank you, Francis Bourlepay. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence.
I'm David Pakman, host of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. Check out my show at davidpakman.com. That's David, PAKMAN.com.
We've been talking on the bonus show, Lewis, as you know, a little bit about Olive Garden. We talked about these unlimited pasta passes that they were offering for a temporary period. Some people wrote in and they said, David, you know, I think you're being a little elitist in your criticism of Olive Garden because some people can't afford to go to nicer restaurants. And every time I say the same thing, which is, there are cheaper restaurants that are better. This is not a question of price. This is a question of Olive Garden being a place that is doing this faux Italian thing with the corporate backing of Darden Restaurants, which is a despicable company that I go out of my way to avoid supporting. Fortunately, I live in a place where you don't need to ever step foot in a chain restaurant. And this is so funny. Hedge fund Starboard Value delivered a 300-page presentation picking apart Darden Restaurants. Darden Restaurants is really not doing well. It's the struggling parent company of the Olive Garden. And they're basically saying the company is incompetent and Olive Garden is completely unqualified to even be cooking pasta. This presentation, I can't explain to you how funny it is. And Darden Restaurants is being criticized, Olive Garden, by the hedge fund. And this is so funny. They've stopped salting the pasta water. Why have they stopped salting their pasta water? According to Darden management, they wanted to get an extended warranty on the pots, and you can't use salt because apparently it damages the pots and is it will void your warranty. You're supposedly an Italian restaurant and you're not salting the pasta water. This is just a basic thing. Not only is that salty pasta, the starchy salty water, often then used in the sauce that goes on the pasta. For proper pasta cooking, you need to salt your water. This is a pasta restaurant. They pride themselves on being an Italian restaurant, and they don't salt the water. They deserve to go out of business.
They do. It's really not cheap. Is it cheap compared to a Michelin-rated Italian restaurant? Of course.
Sure.
But it's not a cheap restaurant. I was shocked the last time I was there at the prices, considering how bad the food was. And yes, of course, the water should taste like the sea. You need to salt it. But you know what? Does it really make a difference considering the quality of the food to begin with?
No, but it kind of is like the cherry on top of, by the way, not only are they cooking things the right way, but in a really bad preparation or with terrible ingredients, they're not even salting the water because they don't want to void the extended warranty on their pasta cooking pots. It's sickening. And by the way, another, you should really check out this report from the hedge fund Starboard Value. They also said that the breadsticks, the much reviled breadsticks that people talk about, taste like hot dog buns. I mean, this was just a brutal destruction here, but Olive Garden continues a brutal assault on culinary traditions.
Yeah, and people just love it. I do feel bad for those people who live in areas where if you want to go out to eat, your only choices might be an Olive Garden or a Chili's. And to those people, I would just say, you know, start cooking. Buy a good cookbook and start making your own Italian food, you know, even though it's nice to be waited on sometimes. Just don't support these places.
All right. Lewis, very, very clear in his advice to those who live in food deserts, buy a cookbook and cook for yourselves. Not terrible advice, Lewis. These companies really should not be supported.
You've been listening to part of the David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. For full audio and video podcasts, interviews, and much more, check out our website, davidpakman.com. That's David, P-A-K-M-A-N.com. And check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/thedavidpakmanshow.